there won't be any hesitation. Why did I tell her all that? Because she's going to survive. You can see it. It's written in her face. Though thousands shall perish around thee, it shall not come near thee. God knows why that is. I didn't tell her everything. Perhaps it wasn't a true story at all. There are only two things I want to remember. One night I got out of bed and went to the bathroom. He had fallen asleep. I filled the basin with warm water and soap and slowly washed myself, as if I were washing someone else. My thighs ached. My whole body was damp with sweat. It was summer and still light, and I could see myself in the mirror, washing away the smell of sex, squeezing out my sponge and soaping it again. My face was pale, and my eyes were dark, and my reflection seemed to flicker, as if it wasn't quite real. The mirror reflected the window behind me, and a bat flew past against the late evening sky. It flew straight, and then it jinked sideways, as if it had sensed me. Suddenly I was terribly hungry. And then it finishes. I don't remember what came next. The second time I was alone. I'd gone back home after visiting the doctor who performed the abortion. I had no idea what to expect. Again, it was summer. I sat by the window, waiting. I had no pain yet, but my body felt wrong. I was waiting and waiting, checking every grain of sensation, waiting for it to begin. I'd said to the doctor that my old nanny would be at home with me, but I hadn't told her anything. She would have looked after me, but she would have been sorrowful. I didn't want that. She would have prayed for me when she thought I wasn't looking. Another pale, late sky. There was a heavy scent of jasmine, and it irritated me, although normally I like jasmine. It smelled artificial, as if someone were pumping the scent into the room. I got up and opened the window, but of course the scent grew stronger. I looked down, and there it was, deep, dark green that was disappearing in the summer dusk, and white flowers like stars. Wave after wave of scent came up as the breeze turned. I leaned out, and that was when I felt the first pain, not strong at all, but final, like something ripping inside me that could never be put back together. She says she hasn't got a story. Andre comes home and says to me, "Hello, Marina, how have you been?" I exist for him, but only because I'm connected to her. They lie on the mattress together, with the child between them. Sometimes I hear them whisper. When he comes into the room, his eyes pass over me as if I am furniture, until he finds her face. She is like Vera. Chapter 23. She's come at last. I don't say anything, but I hold out my hand. I say her name, those two syllables that mean truth. Vera. Her name makes no sound, but she smiles as if she's heard it, and sits on the sofa beside me. It doesn't hurt. All the others hurt me when they come near me. But when Vera sits beside me, I feel nothing but lightness and warmth. Even though I know it's winter, she's wearing her sunflower cotton dress. I don't open my eyes, but I know when I do, the sun will be shining behind the curtains. I was wrong. It isn't winter, it's summer. It's so early in the morning that the garden will be soaked in dew. And when we walk, we'll make black footprints. I know the exact shape of Vera's footprints on wet grass. They are firm and not too small, and she's wearing the low-heeled shoes she always wears to work. Something wonderful is about to happen. I'm trying to remember what it is, but I can't remember. Without opening my eyes, I can tell that Vera is smiling. "You came at last," I say to her. Yes. But what took you so long? Don't be silly, it wasn't any time at all. You remember that first time we went dancing? Of course. I can't dance, I said. She looked at me, and there she was, quite suddenly the most important thing I'd ever seen. She was strong and supple, her waist deeply marked, her breasts round and full, her hips already moving to the music. She was laughing at me because of what I'd said. Don't be silly, everyone can dance, she said. Not me. I'll only tread on your feet and pull you over. She took my right hand in her left. Her skin was warm and moist. She took my other hand and moved closer to me. Now I could smell her, a warm, powdery smell. Then the smell of her hair, which had had the sun on it. Vera loved sitting in the sun. She wasn't laughing at me now. Her face was smooth and serious. Of course you can dance. You just have to let yourself move to the music, she said. But what we did wasn't really dancing. She drew me close and we swayed to the music. The band finished that number and started another. And Vera said, I love this one. We never stepped out on the floor. Next time, she said, we'll dance properly. I'll teach you. But I don't think we ever did. As I remember, we went to a cafe, and I talked for a long time about Mayakovsky. I would have had to go to dancing lessons, and I didn't want to. There were more important things. She's still there, still smiling, waiting. I can see her breasts and her hips, which I haven't yet touched. I believe that she's a virgin, and I'm right. Her life has been work, friends, dancing. But she is ready to move on. I can see her clear, serious face with the half-smile on it. One of her hands is lifted, ready to settle on my shoulder. If I made the slightest effort, she would dance away with me. But I stand still. She's still here. She must have been sitting beside me for a long time because I've been asleep. One of those others came up and did things to me. I can't see them clearly. They're like clouds I could put my hand through. But Vera is solid and sharp. My eyes fill with tears, and I put out my hand to touch her. The weight of her thigh presses down my blanket. Did you go away? I say. She shakes her head and smiles. I've been here all the time. She uncrosses her legs and glances away from me at something I can't turn my head to see. Don't go, Vera, I say. Don't worry. When I go, you'll come with me. She smiles. She raises one hand, as if to settle it on my shoulder. It touches the open wound there, but I don't flinch. I want her to touch me. I want her to dance me away from here. Don't worry, she repeats. This time you'll come with me. I can't see Vera anymore. They're all like clouds now. My feet have been cold for a long time, but now the cold has reached my knees. Vera? She doesn't answer, but she squeezes my hand. Cold, I tell her. Marina straightens up from Mikhail's side. How awful she looks, Anna thinks, if only Andrei could get something for her cough. What did he say? She asks. He's cold. But I can't light the bougie again. There's only enough to heat the room up a bit before we sleep.
I know.
He doesn't recognize me anymore.
He doesn't recognize me either.
But he spoke to you. He took your hand. I saw him.
He thought I was someone else. You know that your father's going, don't you?
Yes.
He isn't suffering. That's what matters, says Marina, almost to herself.
Anna looks at her father's face, carved, yellowish, like a mask of wood. His mouth gapes a little.
He can't go on like this, she says.
No, he can't, and he won't.
On the mattress, Andrei is showing Kolya chess moves. He's made a chessboard from paper, with tiny paper pieces which Anna drew and cut out. They've had to burn the wooden chess set in the Buzhuika. Andrei's legs are too swollen for him to get to the hospital today. Kolya watches the movement of the paper chess pieces. Andrei isn't playing real chess. His knights thunder freely over the field, snatching pawns, stymieing kings and bishops.
The horses are hungry, says Kolya. Give them something to eat.
Of course. Here's the hay, and here are their oats. You hold out the oats, Kolya, with your hand flat. Like this. Then they can't nip your fingers by mistake. Perfect.
They're gobbling it all up. They're trying to eat my fingers, says Kolya.
There is a gleam of pleasure in his wasted face.
Hold out your hand and give them this apple.
Then they'll be ready to fight again.
Marina puts another blanket on top of Mikhail. She folds it under his chin.
It's time to turn him again, Andrei says from the mattress.
They are turning him every 2 hours now to relieve his bed sores.
No, says Marina. I don't think he wants us to touch him any more.
His skin's like paper. It's got to be looked after.
I think he's going, Andrei. Have a look. But before Andrei can heave himself off the mattress, Mikhail begins to snore, deep in his throat. A long, snoring breath. A pause. Then the gravelly start of another snore.
You're right, says Andrei. There's no need to turn him.
Why is he making that funny noise?
Asks Kolya.
He's very ill.
I know that.
He's dying.
You didn't have to tell me. I knew without you even telling me, says Kolya coldly.
He bends over the chess pieces, excluding the rest of the room.
Would you like another apple? You're still hungry, aren't you? Come on, boy. Come on. Don't be frightened.
He picks up the paper knight on horseback, holds him close to his lips, and disappears with him under the blankets. As Mikhail continues to snore, they listen to Kolya whispering to his little horse. Chapter 24. It's on her way back from the bread queue that Anna meets Fedya, dragging his loaded sledge. For once, he doesn't try to avoid her, but stops and stands planted in the snow before her. There they are, for the first time, face to face, like real neighbours. Hunger has eaten out hollows in his face and greyed his skin.
I took our little one to the cemetery today, he says. Zina wanted to come, but she wasn't equal to it.
There is nothing to be said. It was just a few months ago that Zina came out onto the landing to show Anna the new baby, swaddled deep in his cream woolen shawl, fists crossed on his chest. It was another world. Sunlight glowed outside the dirty landing window that no one could climb high enough to clean. Anna leaned over the baby and smelled his warm, damp, powdery smell. It should have happened again and again, for years. Zina would have come out onto the landing with the latest bulletins when Fedya was safely out of the way. Vanka's first tooth. Vanka pulling himself up on the furniture. Vanka's first tantrum.
He rolled over today, all on his own. When I turned around, there he was, lying on his tummy.
He knows Fedya already.
He always gets excited when his daddy comes home, don't you, Vanka? Oh, he's dribbling so much. Look, this jacket's soaked through. Do you think he can be getting a tooth already?
But little Vanka, lifeless as wood, has already joined the queue at the cemetery. Not many people get buried these days with the ground like iron. Bodies pile up in the frost outside the cemetery gates. Some don't even get that far. They stay at home in their beds because no one has the strength to drag them to the cemetery. The living rig a curtain round the dead in their corner of the room. I'm so sorry, says Anna. Fedya spreads his hands and looks down at them, as if he's surprised they're empty. Then he clears his throat.
There's an apartment building down by the Baltic station that's been shelled, overlooking the canal.
A mate of mine told me about it when I was on my way back from the cemetery. It was on fire, but they managed to put the worst of it out before the whole building went up. There's a reception floor made of wooden blocks. Most of it's still all right.
Now that he says it, she can smell the stink of charred wood. He's lashed a blanket over his heaped sledge. Was there much left? She asks.
Could be as much as a sledge load, if you get a move on. The building's safe, but watch out for yourself. There have been a couple of fights over there already. One guy had a knife.
Thanks. His big hands pull at the sledge ropes.
Zina's very taken with that likeness you did of Alvanka. She keeps it by her all the time. I've got to get back to the works now, but I'll be leaving her with the wood. And she's got her ration card safe.
He clears his throat again.
She wanted to keep the baby at home with her, so I had to tell her it wasn't the proper thing. She's not herself. But I don't know when I'll be able to get home again. The way we're fixed at the works, there's no time for that. You get a few hours kip if you're lucky, and then back on shift.
They are still rolling tanks off the line at the Kirov works, she knows, even though the workers there are dying like everyone else. Fedya has become exactly the kind of heroic worker Zina's always believed him to be. He's taken his baby son to the cemetery, and now he'll go straight back to work.
Don't worry. I'll keep an eye on her, says Anna.
She looks straight at him.
You know, Zina's always welcome to come into us if she wants.
Fedya looks down at his hands with the delicacy of a decent man. She always knew he was that.
No. No, I bet she doesn't. She'll be all right on her own.
If you say so.
My father's dying, so maybe you're right.
He nods.
Zina told me.
But he can't do it. Even now, thinks Anna, watching him, he can't bring himself to say he's sorry that my father's dying.
Those fascist bastards don't know what's coming to them.
Excuse my language.
I don't know what they've got themselves into.
We'll find them space in Russian earth, Anna says.
You're right there.
It wasn't me who said it. It was Pushkin.
Well, he knew what he was talking about. There's space all right. We'll bury them.
They stare at each other in sudden, savage unity.
You don't go down as far as the station. It's on this side of the canal, the Obvodny. You can't miss it.
Thank you.
Zina told me what you did for our little one about the sugar.
It wasn't much. Fedya's fists clench on the rope.
Nothing could have helped him. They made sure of that. They might as well have put their hands around his throat and squeezed. Alvanka didn't stand a chance.
Back in the apartment, Anna and Marina calculate. Her father's breaths are noisier now, more widely spaced. A thread of pulse jumps in his wrist. Before Andrei left for the hospital, he raised Mikhail up on a heap of pillows to ease his breathing. Mikhail's skin is darkening, growing dusky around mouth and nose.
It'll take me at least an hour to get there, says Anna, maybe more. I'll have to stop and rest. And then I've got to dig the blocks out. Is it worth it? You'll wear yourself out and there might not be any wood left by the time you get there.
We've got to get fuel. I'll take some of my ration with me.
Here, have this half slice before you go.
I can't take your bread, Marina. Because once that starts, it's the end. If you even let yourself begin to imagine getting more than your own ration, it's like rousing up a wolf inside you. People collapse in the street, and straight away there's someone else on top of them, going through their pockets for bread or a ration cart. If you go too close, they snarl you away. You could lie all night long, dreaming of the crust you've put aside for Kolya when he wakes up. Anything, so that he won't cry and cry. Without knowing it, your hand could slip out and touch the surface of the bread. The bread feels as warm as life in the room's glacial midnight. Just a touch can't do any harm, you'll tell yourself. So you touch it. Your fingers work away at the rough surface. A few crumbs loosen and are carried to your mouth on a finger damp with saliva. In the morning, the bread's gone, your hand is empty, and Kolya cries. Go on, take it, Anna. Think of all the calories you're burning, getting our bread, and now our wood. You're keeping us alive.
And what if you were to collapse out there? What would become of us all?
She should keep on refusing. But she doesn't.
This morning, on the way to the bakery, she found herself leaning against a wall, pressing her forehead into it. Already the cold of the stone was branching into her brain, making its home there, and telling her she should rest. Rest until cold became warmth and sent her to sleep. The silence of the city gathered around her, fold after fold. The city put its hands over her lips.
Listen. Can't you hear that we're all sleeping? Why wear yourself out struggling when you could rest too? Come here. Lie down.
But she crushed a handful of snow and rubbed it over the inside of her wrists until she couldn't hear the voice anymore. She tricked herself by saying she would only walk 10 steps, then she would rest again. She counted the steps, as she used to count them with Kolya. And one, and two, and three, and four. When she got to 10, she didn't stop, but counted another 10 steps, and another, until she reached the bakery. Marina's bread dissolves on her tongue. Marina watches in a way that seems familiar, although Anna can't place it. That fiercely focused gaze, those lips working a little, as if Marina is eating too, nourishing herself on what she's given away. It's 2:30, and already growing dark by the time Anna sets out with Kolya's empty sledge bumping behind her. She has a couple of empty sacks, too, and some twine to tie them onto the sledge once they're filled. It's only a child's sledge, but it'll carry a fair load. The streets are almost empty. She passes the hump of a body frozen into a doorway, covered with drifted snow. It looks like a bag of rubbish, but Anna knows it's a body because she saw it before the snow hid it. It's an old woman. Maybe she stopped to rest on the way back from fetching her ration. Anna doesn't like going past the park anymore. There are people sitting on benches, swathed in snow, planted like bulbs to wait for spring. They stay there day after day. No one comes to take them away. It's cold. So cold. Anna adjusts the scarf she has wound around her face. She'll rest for a couple of minutes. No longer than that, because in her weakened state the cold could easily finish her off. The scorching frost goes down into her lungs like a knife. She coughs, gasps, shifts her weight from foot to foot and bats her hands together. Her gloved hands make a muffled, ghostly sound. She thinks of the bulbs under their coverlet of snow and shivers. Nothing seems surprising anymore, not even the bodies piled by the Karpovka Canal, or outside the cemeteries. Andrei has told her about them. They are like two walls on either side of the road. It is not surprising that her father is dying, while Andrei makes his way to the hospital to work, leaning on the cherrywood stick, which he needs more than Anna does now. On his swollen legs, the skin is drawn and shiny. He labours on, as she does, 10 steps, and then 10 steps more, passing the bodies of the dead. They lie exposed, charred by frost, until the next snowfall covers them. Being dead is normal. You have to patrol yourself all the time to stop yourself slipping over the border between this world and the next. If you let go and sit down in no man's land, the snipers of cold and hunger will soon finish you off. She walks on through lifeless silence. There are no dogs, no pigeons, no cats, no plump, rosy-cheeked children screaming with excitement as their sledges hiss over the frozen snow, and then home to a bowl of hot milk or a piece of gingerbread as big as your hand. Anna's stomach gripes, and she swallows down the taste in her mouth. Her father has always chewed licorice root to keep his teeth strong and white. She found 2 sticks of it in his camphorwood box when she was taking down the box to burn it. She made Kolya chew on the licorice root too, although he cried and said his teeth hurt and there was blood in his mouth. When she felt his gums, he was right. There was blood on her fingers, and his front teeth were loose. Perhaps his second teeth were pushing them out? After all, at Kolya's age, you expect wobbly teeth.
The licorice root has become yellow and stringy, and it hardly has any taste left, but they keep on chewing it. It's good to have something in your mouth. There are three things which she can give to Kolya when he cries with hunger and there is no food. One is the licorice root. The second is a strip cut from an old leather school bag. Anna has already boiled the leather for stock, but the softened, chewy strips that remain seem to comfort Kolya, and perhaps there is still some goodness in them. The last thing she offers, when everything else has failed, is her own finger. He sucks it, clutching her hand with both his hands, and sometimes he goes to sleep. "Yes, sleep," says Anna aloud as the image of Kolya dissolves into the snow. "Sleep all winter and wake up when spring's come." If only she could do that for him. Wrap him up like a squirrel and put him to sleep until all this is over. It's unbearable, the way he wakes up and tells her, "Anna, my stomach hurts," as if she doesn't already know. He looks at her, accusing her. "Guess what, Kolya? It's time for your honey," she says. And he follows her with his eyes as the honey jar comes out, and the special pewter spoon chosen because it is the smallest they have. But the honey won't last forever. What about when it's gone, and there's nothing left to distract him with at the start of a day which will only bring him 2 slices of bread and a couple of hours' warmth?
"Can't I have 2 spoonfuls? Just today? I promise I won't ask for it tomorrow," he bargains.
Calculation flashes in his eyes. Hunger's making him older than he should be. She shakes her head. "We've got to make it last, Kolya." The life dies out of his face, and he watches as she puts the honey high up, out of reach and out of sight. He's a good boy. But one day he clawed at her legs, trying to drag her down so that he could climb and get at the honey. Those snow devils are dancing again. It's only the wind spinning off the drifts. But the devils have faces, and they take on the shapes of people she knows. There's Yevgenia, tossing a clod of earth over her shoulder. There's Katya, shaking back her hair. There's her father, sharp against the evening sun, holding a trout he's caught. "I'm not going crazy. It's just hunger. Let's see what I can remember. Facts. Measles can be identified by white spots on the insides of the mouth. What are those spots called? Elizaveta Antonovna always checks in the mouth if one of the children develops a rash with fever. Sometimes their mothers bring them in with fever and rush off before we can call them back. But you can't blame the mothers too much. They have to work. They can't take endless days off. The children never disobey Elizaveta Antonovna when she tells them to open their mouths so she can look inside. I thought so. Coplic spots. Isolate this child immediately or we'll have an epidemic in the nursery." And off she goes to fill in her report in triplicate, leaving the child standing there, flushed and dazed, mouth still open. "It's all right, you can shut your mouth now," I say. And that's when they start to cry. Did I really work there all those years? Imagine what Elizaveta Antonovna would say if she saw Zina's dead baby. "Definite signs of maternal neglect. I shall be making the fullest possible report to the committee." Or Kolya chewing my old school bag, a highly inappropriate diet for a child of this age group. "Kindly report to me for nutritional re-education, Anna Mikhailovna." One thing's for certain. Elizaveta Antonovna will survive. If she's not on special rations, she'll have wangled her way off to Moscow on a military flight. She'll be there, sure enough, making the fullest possible report of a highly confidential nature. At the street corner, a man carrying a baccara rug glances across at the bundled figure pulling an empty child's sledge. Is it possible that he heard a laugh? People are going crazy in the streets these days. "What did I say to Fedya?" "We'll find them space in Russian earth. Space, yes, and vengeance." I didn't even know I was going to say it, but the words jumped out of my mouth. I know it's Pushkin, but I can't remember what poem. My father would know. Let's see if I can remember any more. You hate us anyway.
And for what? Answer me.
Because in the blazing wreck of Moscow we blanked the insolent will which made you tremble. Is that why you hate us? Because we made our earth swallow the juggernaut which crushed nation after nation, and with our blood redeemed the freedom, honour and peace of Europe. Is that why you hate us? But there's a lot more. I'll remember it in a minute. One, and two, and three, and... We must have had to learn the whole thing at school. Funny how things sink into you when you don't even know that you know them. It's a safe bet that it's Pushkin. Yes, he's right. That's all we want. Freedom and peace. So it's all happened before. That's what he's saying. The same suffering, the same invasions and battles. We've had to face it once, and now we're facing it again. Only the people are different. Everything's happened before and will go on happening. Yes, it's coming back. I wish he could hear me reciting poetry like this. Will Russian earth not rise and bristle with steel, stubble, glitter? It's all exactly like now. You'd think Pushkin had visited the Kirov works. You'd think he was with us, watching all this. I must write it down when I get home, before I forget it again. Steel, stubble, glitter. That was it. Ah, I wish I'd remembered that line before, when I was talking to Fedya. He'd have liked it. Chapter 25. It's dark by the time Anna reaches the burned building. The charred stench of it catches in her throat. She stands 100 meters away, watching. There are shadows on the snow ahead, and a couple of bobbing lanterns. They seem to spill light and then wipe it up again, without illuminating anything. She grips the rope of her sledge as she approaches the building. Part of the roof has caved in, where the shell hit it, and the second and third floors of the building have collapsed along a third of their width. Heaps of rubble lie on the pavement, but the main entrance has been cleared. As she watches, a shadow flits inside. If people are still going in, then there must be wood left. She moves forward over rough, blackened ridges of ice where snow has been melted by the fire and has frozen again. She pulls her scarf closer over mouth and nose, steps across the threshold, and lifts the sledge behind her. There's someone in front of her, carrying a light that throws his shadow back over her. She does not think of speaking. Each of them moves like a ghost through the ruins, lost in its own dimension. The figure darts sideways and his light disappears. But it's still not quite dark. The space closes around her, packed with shadows. On her right, a goblin red light jumps from another doorway. She edges forward silently and peers into the small room, which must have been a vestibule. The floor is churned up, and in the middle a little fire burns, close to a woman who's hacking at a thick column of wood more than 2 meters long. The woman's saw looks as if it comes from a child's carpentry set.
"Fuck off out of here. This is mine," says the woman.
She stares up at Anna from where she's squatting over the wood. Her shawl has fallen back onto her shoulders, exposing her face. She looks old, but probably she is young. The saw won't cut, not only because it's a child's toy rather than a tool, but also because the wood is hardwood. Mahogany, probably. A newel post, or something like that, put into the house when it was young and magnificent. That woman will never be able to cut it up, and she won't be able to drag it home in one piece because she's as weak as a cat. But she won't leave it, either. She stares up at Anna, not aggressive anymore, and certainly not asking for help. There are only 3 things to deal with here: the wood, the cold, and her own weakness. None of them is negotiable. Anna backs out of the room. She's in the big, bare, stone-floored hallway that stinks of smoke. She feels her way to the stairs, in case the banisters are still there. But her hand touches nothing. Upstairs, something settles with a wheezing sound. There might be stuff worth having up there. It's too late to hope for furniture, but some of the wooden fittings might have been missed. But she stays still, pinned at the foot of the stone stairs, listening to the noise of the building as it settles on itself. Dust teeming into crevices, cavity rubble slipping down the inside of walls that hang at crazy angles. If she climbed to the turn of the stairs, she'd be able to look up straight through the gash in the roof. A door slams. There can't be people still living up there, surely, in the undamaged rooms. No, it's one of those tricks of sound that makes you hear life long after it's finished. That's why she can't move. It's her father's breathing back in the apartment that keeps her pinned here. All her life he's been breathing. Why didn't she count those breaths when she had the chance? Why didn't she stop still and listen on just one of those bad-tempered mornings when she was late for work and Kolya was whinging that he didn't want his porridge because he always had porridge every single day? She'd never once stopped to bless the fact that her father still breathed. She certainly never stopped to bless the everyday porridge. Instead, she hustled Kolya into leggings, tied his scarf crosswise over his chest and back, crammed him into jacket, fur cap, mittens, and don't forget the extra pair of socks in case the ones he's wearing get wet if the snow goes over the top of his boots, and then hurried him out of the door before he began to sweat. In a rush of spite, she'd even slammed the door as she went out so that it would wake her father. Why should he sleep? Anna listens to the noises of the burned building. There's her father's pulse. Weak but steady, it ticks on, like drop after drop of water falling into a basin. Anna shakes her head to get the sound out of her ears, but it goes on. She can't tell if it's real. Perhaps the whole of the city is thinning into a dream, becoming transparent as it starves. In a few more days, if she lives, she'll be able to walk through walls, skim the surface of the Neva, and glide from one side of Leningrad to another at the speed of her own thoughts. The sound of her father's pulse continues, and she listens. Is she even alive herself? She rolls back the thick cuff of her coat and feels under it. Her arm is thin and cold, but soft. When people die, they go hard as wood. She strips off a glove and puts her hand against her mouth. Yes, she is breathing. The pulse sound shifts, steadies, and resolves itself into the tick of a clock which has survived shelling and fire and goes on telling the time to no one. The tick grows louder, elbowing her out. She'll go. She'll get out of this tomb, never mind about the wood. It will all have been taken already. But as she turns, a man comes from the back of the hall, holding a candle, hauling a sack. He stops beside Anna.
You don't want to hang about here, he says. You want to get off home, quick.
Then he too catches the sound of the clock.
Keeps on going, doesn't it? Even though there's nowhere to wind it up. Stupid, just like us.
How long has she been standing here? She's wasted too much time already. Whatever made her think she could leave without getting any wood for the Bouzhouika? She must have been crazy. By the retreating light of the man's candle, Anna picks her way to the back of the hall and into the reception room. The light of several candle stubs sends a dozen shadows swooping up the walls and folding across one another. Heaps of rubbish on the floor turn into women, who crouch there, grunting as they lever up the last few blocks of wood. How vast this room is! It falls away into blackness, like a cave. Surely this could never have been an apartment. It's a ballroom from more than 50 years ago. People would have crowded in here under chandeliers, the naked white shoulders of women gleaming against the men's stiff black. They danced on this floor, those former people. In the candlelight, the diggers look like women on a battlefield, stripping clothes and rings from the dead. The air is thick with effort as they scrabble in the dirt, trying to prise up the wood that remains. When Anna goes too close to a pram, which contains 5 or 6 lumps of wood, its owner spits like a cat. But here there's a space. Anna kneels and harnesses the sledge securely around her waist. She sweeps her hands across the floor in front of her. Nothing but empty grooves where the wood was laid. She twists round and sweeps behind her. Again, nothing. She'll try closer to the wall. As she crawls, her hands strike a block. Just one. She pulls, but it won't give way. It's firmly stuck, and that's why it's been left for easier pickings. Anna takes out the chisel from the bag around her waist and begins to lever. There's a suggestion of give, like the first weakness in a sound tooth. She levers again, until the chisel slips and drives into the side of her other hand. Breathing quickly and shallowly to dull the pain, she pulls off her glove and brings her hand up to her mouth. The taste is warm and salt, but as she lips it carefully, she can tell it's not a bad cut. Lucky she kept her gloves on. She sucks again, drawing in the taste of her own blood. It tastes good. Now she pulls the glove off her other hand and holds it between her teeth so that she can gouge at the underside of the wood with her bare hand. The block comes out of its socket so suddenly that she falls backward, still clutching the chisel. Anna stuffs her prize into her sack. But she mustn't drag the sledge behind her anymore. One of the other women could creep up and take the wood out of her sack without her seeing. Anna crawls forward again, but now the sledge is in front of her, shielded by her body, as she gropes across the ashy, stinking ground. People are all around the walls, levering up half-charred blocks that remain where fire must have swept around the side of the room. Anna finds her own meter of space and squeezes in, wedging herself against another woman, who's trying to prise up blocks with a knife. She's lit a whole candle, and in its light Anna can see that she's using a solid silver knife with initials twined just above the blade. She doesn't look the monogram type, but then gold and silver travel like lice these days. A silver knife's no good for this anyway, too soft. She needs a chisel to get those blocks up. Stealthily, Anna applies her own chisel, shielding it with her body so the woman won't spot it. Block by block, the burned wood comes up. It's badly charred, but at least a third of it will still be good for burning in the Borsuika. She prizes out a couple more. They are looser here, and they come up as sweetly as new potatoes.
Comrade!
The whisper is hoarse.
You've got tools, haven't you? Give me a lend of them, just for a minute. I swear I'll give them back.
Anna's hand tightens on the chisel. Once it's gone, she won't get it back. The woman's big and better fed than Anna. Maybe she's got a knife, a real one tucked away in her belt. Maybe she's seen that Anna's sack is already half full. Anna does not answer. The whisper begins again, whinging, singing, and the woman's body barges against hers.
I swear to God you'll get it back. Let me just get up a few blocks.
Anna stuffs the chisel under her coat, her skin prickling. A wash of dirty breath flows over her face as the woman's voice rises.
Igor! Igor! Over here, quick! She's taking my wood!
But the woman has been kneeling too long and her legs have gone to sleep. As she lunges after Anna, she loses her balance and falls, snuffing out her own candle. Now the shadowed hall is safety. Anna flattens herself against the farthest wall and listens. The woman's voice has died away. No sign of Igor, if he even exists. Anna has the chisel, the sledge, and her half-full sack of wood. That's enough. It was stupid to imagine I could ever carry two sacks home, thinks Anna, as she ties the sack onto the sledge with her twine. This weight's going to be enough. She'll go a few hundred metres, then she'll have a quarter slice of bread. That'll be enough to turn the air back into air, instead of thick, resistant glue that leans against you as you try to go forward. She stiffens at the regular tramp of boots outside the building. Soldiers on patrol. The ones Yevgenia talked about who'll stop you and shoot you on the spot if you've got more food or ration cards than you ought to have. And here she is, in a building she's got no right to enter with a load of looted wood. But the footsteps don't slacken, although a splodge of light hits the entrance to the apartment building. Imagine, they've got torches. She can even hear their voices. Low, hurried, and perhaps a little frightened. Yes, you're right, you should be frightened. We should all be frightened of one another these days. And we should be frightened of ourselves. Now they've passed, and it's time to go out onto the street, into the blessed night air. They're shelling again.
She pauses to get the direction. But it's all right. Nowhere near home. It's coming from over towards Smolny again, by the military headquarters. It's going to be one of those iron nights the bombers love, with a frost so deep that everything can't help sparkling, even when there's only a quarter moon. The sledge runners squeak as Anna makes her way slowly down the pathway between drifts of uncleared snow. The streets are empty. It's too cold and too dangerous. Everyone's indoors, although it can't be 5 o'clock yet. They're curled in their beds, conserving body heat, while another layer of frost grows on the window panes. Every window she passes is blank with blackout. It's impossible to tell if the people in the houses are living or dead. In all the city, it seems that she's the only one moving, creeping forward with her load of wood. But of course she isn't. At the next crossroads, a shadow comes away from the wall and crosses into her path, a man in a fur cap with a candle lantern slung over his arm. He opens his lantern, takes out a match, strikes it on the heel of his boot, lights the wick, closes the little glass door again, and holds the light up to Anna's face. He's wearing steel-tipped boots, not felt boots, thinks Anna, hypnotized. Why isn't he wearing felt boots? His feet will freeze.
Hello? What have we got here?
His face looks strange. After a second, she realizes that it looks unfamiliar because he is fully fleshed.
It's a long time since she's seen anyone who looked well-fed. What's that in the sack?
My brother, says Anna. I'm taking him to the cemetery. His eyes are set deep in folds of flesh, and she can't see his expression.
Poor kid. Little un, was he?
He was 5.
He looks like a little un. Then that's all you got in there, is it?
Of course it is.
"'Cause the reason I ask is I wouldn't like to think you were telling me the tale. "'Nice-looking kid, was he?'
"'Yes.
"'Let's see, then.
"'No, you can't do that to him. "'I told you he's dead. Leave him alone.' "'For a moment, it is Corlia lying on the sledge, "'like so many other children, stiff and blue. "'Perhaps her words have killed him. "'No, I won't let you touch him.
"'I won't do your brother any harm.' Just having a little look, that's all.
He's playing with her. He's got the energy to do that.
He's not starving.
He puts a hand on her arm and she pulls it back.
Don't worry, darling, I'm not interested in you. A little crow like you's not worth a bite for a man like me. No, it's your brother who's got me all curious.
He lifts the lantern higher and his eyes glisten at her. They're human eyes, set in folds of human flesh. But her skin crawls. Something has been wiped from them that should be there. He could do anything. It's only chance that'll hold him back. She stands quite still, retreating deep inside herself as his lantern light moves over her. After a long time, he puts his lantern down on the packed snow and kneels by her sledge. Expertly, he unties Anna's knots and opens the sack.
There you are. I knew you were telling me the tale. Funny sort of dead brother this is.
He upends the sack and tips the wood onto the snow. Thought flickers on and off in Anna like a faulty light. He'll kill me. He won't kill me.
Is that all you got? Pathetic, I call it. Thought you might have something worth having tucked down the bottom of the sack, but no, you're a real little crow, all right. All the same, wood's worth something. Pick it up and put it back in the sack.
Her fingers blunder. He'll get angry. She's crouched in the snow and he looks down on her from his height. His right leg is by her cheek. The steel-tipped boot shifts, touches her, shifts away. He could smash her skull like an egg. The boot shifts. She shovels wood into the sack. I must live. Corlia in bed, twisting to look at the door, asking where I am. If I die, he'll die.
Not trying to shove a bit of that wood up your jumper, are you?
No, no.
Because if you did, I'd have your clothes off you as well.
He says it calmly, almost pleasantly. The wood's all back in the sack now. She crouches on all fours, looking up at him, not daring to stand until he gives the word. The man lashes the sack of wood back onto the sledge, picks up the rope, and slings it over his shoulder. Without saying anything more, he turns and heads off in the direction from which Anna has come. Anna listens to the squeak of the sledge until it fades into silence. Stiffly, she scrambles back to her feet. "But he didn't get the chisel," she tells herself. "He didn't get the last quarter slice of bread." She crosses her arms on her chest and beats her hands against her arms to warm herself. She wants to run, but she's too cold. At least he doesn't know where she lives. She swallows down the taste in her mouth, then takes out the piece of bread and cradles it in her hand as she begins to walk down the bare, blank street, grating off crumbs with her teeth and softening them with her tongue. Chapter 26. It is much harder to walk without the sledge. Strange that it should be so, when the sledge was heavy to pull. But without its anchor, she might drift anywhere. She might even stop moving and not know it. No regular squeak of runners behind her now. Only herself, empty-handed, stumbling home through ruts of frozen snow. To the next lamppost. To the next. To that corner. To the second courtyard entrance. She passes two more soldiers in their long coats and felt boots, who look at her but don't speak. Shelling's begun again. The air shudders, but nothing comes near. It's not far to go now. A kilometre, no more, and she'll be home. Behind her, a cough. She turns, and there's the flicker of a candle lantern. He's after her. He's followed her. She's got nothing. He knows that. Now he's taken her sledge and her load of wood. What more does he want?
I'll have your clothes off you as well.
Anna reaches under her coat and grasps the chisel.
Anna!
The voice wavers across the wasteland of ice that separates them.
Anna, it's you, isn't it?
It's me. Yevgenia!
She would never have known that voice, hoarse and cracked like an old woman's. But if Yevgenia says so, it must be her. Anna shakes her head to get the numbness of cold out of it. The figure glides across the snow towards her, holding up its lantern.
Thought it was you. I've been following you, didn't you see me? You've been weaving about all over the place.
Have I?
Yeah. Let's have a look at you.
For the second time, a candle lantern swings up to Anna's face. But now there's Yevgenia's sharp yellow face behind it, and her human eyes.
Here, take my arm.
She links arms with Anna, as if they're two girls off to a dance together. But it's nice, the feeling of Yevgenia's arm across her back supporting her.
Come on, it's not far.
But you're heading the wrong way, Yevgenia. I'm going home.
You'll never make it like that. We've got to get you warmed up, or someone will find you flopped in a snowdrift tomorrow.
I'm not cold, Yevgenia. I'm warm.
Yeah, you feel warm, but you're freezing. That's what people feel like just before they snuff it. Come on.
They go on past heaped, dirty white snowdrifts that gleam in the light of Yevgenia's lantern. There's a man propped against the drift, head sunk onto his chest. A rind of yesterday's fresh snow covers his feet. His boots have gone. They turn off the avenue, into a narrow street, and then a narrower one. Anna knows these streets, off the broad public avenue where the trams run and people walk to shops and offices with quick, firm purpose, into a world of children screeching from apartment window to apartment window, women on doorsteps who stop talking and stare as you pass, and a drunk snarling at nothing. Now there isn't a flicker of movement. The streets are canyons of uncleared snow. The windows are masked with blackout. An entire house has been torn out by a shell. All around there's heavy, dead silence. The silence of a mother whom even her own children's crying can't wake.
Here we are, up these steps. We're on the third floor.
The two women pass through a doorway, which is fantastically looped and wreathed in ice from a burst pipe above. A stalactite stabs the side of Anna's head.
The stairway to the third floor is raw and damp.
This is us.
Yevgenia unlocks the door, and they go in. The room is warm. Smells of smoke, warm flesh, frosty bedclothes, lamp oil, fat and old boots wash around Anna. She'd almost forgotten it. This is what life smells like.
Sit down on here.
It's a bed, covered with heaps of coats. Yevgenia kneels down, pulls off Anna's boots, and begins to rub her feet.
How long have you been wandering about like that for? Your feet are like blocks of ice. Let's have a look. Oh, no, you're not too bad. You're not frostbitten, but don't go near the stove yet.
Her feet are hurting now. They didn't hurt all that time when she was walking. Yevgenia's pulled off her gloves as well, and now she's rubbing Anna's hands between her own.
You shouldn't be out after dark. I told you before, it's dangerous. You don't know who's out there.
I do know. Yevgenia looks up.
What happened?
A man took my sledge and the wood I'd found.
Yeah, I thought something must have happened. You didn't look like yourself. Did he beat you up?
No.
Well, you were lucky then. We may have eaten all the real rats, but we've still got the human ones around. He could easily have knocked you over the head. That's all it takes. One shove and you're in the snow and you don't get up.
When I saw you, I thought it was him again.
I thought you didn't look too pleased to see me.
Yevgenia's voice is so different. Where it used to be full and deep, it's hoarse, as if she's been ill. She looks different too. Thinner, of course, though nowhere near as thin as lots of people. She's not starving, and she's not short of wood either. Just think of leaving a stove lit when you're not even at home. She must have plenty of wood. Yes, there's a pile at the foot of the bed. Good stuff, too. It looks like sawn-up planking from one of the old wooden houses they're tearing down. You're still working?
Yeah, still working. Though now that the factory's down to 20% production, I do most of my work here.
She points to a corner of the room which is curtained off by a sheet. You bring them back here?
Well, the balls would drop off if we did it in the street. Besides, they like their own comforts. Samovar lit, stove burning and all that. They're a bit